Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and this is going to be a very fun conversation. I've got Ramon Menon with me. Hey, Ramon.
Hello, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing well. For those who, you probably don't know this, but if you go back to episode 318 of the Discover Indie Film podcast, Ramon was on Discover Indie Film in November of 2022 for his film, The Pay, which took home awards at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2021. He is a returning champion. You are back on the podcast because you came back to the Sherman Oaks Film Festival last year in 2023 with another new short. And the title is My Scary Indian Wedding. And you walked home with awards again, Outstanding Short Film Horror, and a new award. We actually adjusted the awards we give. You also won Outstanding Creativity Horror Film. Because I'll just share, not many, you're the first person to hear this, but with our jury, the jury said to me, can we just use the built-in categories that are built into Film Freeway? And that shows like writing, directing, production design, creativity. And I'm like, sure, we can use those categories. And so now we give an award for best creativity. And that was you, outstandingly creative.
Thank you. I really appreciate you and the jury for giving us that award. I don't know for what movie you were watching, but I'll take it.
It's true. Our most of our dynamic in podcasts and conversations with or without microphones is you sardonically criticize yourself and your own work. And I tell you, it's brilliant and you kick serious motherfucking ass. I had to get in the first curse of the podcast.
Yeah, and then you unfortunately set it off now, and here it fucking goes.
Here it fucking goes. Well, it has the explicit warning inside all the podcast delivery systems. What are they called? Podcatchers, whatever. But so we can curse.
Yeah, this is the reason I like to come back, especially to come see you, Jeff, because you allow. You allow all this shit talking,
and you know we encourage
it. Q&As too. Like the most fun Q&As are at Sherman Oaks.
Well, your Q&A at Sherman Oaks was in 2021 was so fun because, of course, all our theaters do serve alcohol. The new one does too. The new theater, which you haven't gotten to see in person yet, on every seat is a leather recliner, powered leather recliner, and there's a little QR code that you scan with your phone, and you can order food or beverage brought to your seat. It's one of those.
Wow, it's like the Alamo Draft House. Nice.
Exactly. Nice. Only that's exactly what it's like. And so you can get your scotch your whiskey.
And my whiskey soda, my black
whiskey soda. Yeah, I have a friend who loves whiskey ginger. Use ginger ale.
Yeah, no, I'm no brown man. Just stick to straight up brown liquor with a little bit of soda.
With brown soda.
Yeah, I mean, if there was brown soda, I'd have it. But unfortunately, there's only white soda. So.
All right. So you're just doing soda water with sometimes whiskey soda. Exactly. Yeah. But you know what? Excellent strategy, because I know the carbonation in that soda water makes our bodies absorb the alcohol a little quicker.
Yeah, it's the typical Indian man's drink. Like you can't. It's like my grandfather had it, my father had it, and now I continue the tradition. And let's see how far this keeps going.
That's one of the reasons why I have a soft spot for Scotch whiskey, because my grandfather was a Chivas Regal guy.
Nice. Yeah. Well,
and he left behind a nearly 2.5-3 foot tall 4-gallon jug of Chivas Regal.
Wow. That is, I mean, now that's an heirloom right there.
Yeah. Well, he had a bar at home and he had a bunch of friends and they just bought him. I think it was probably a gift, but anyway, it's a lovely tradition to know what your forefathers, your ancestors imbibed and to keep it going.
Yes, 100%. It's a part of the cinema that we do too.
And I am actually, I was thinking, oh, this is a segue because my scary Indian wedding. All right, first, let me start talking about it. Because if people want to hear your life story, they should listen to the November 2022 episode with you. If people want to hear your whole, I made you talk, right? I did the usual discovery new film thing and said, when did you first get interested in film? Were you a creative kid? All that. So people can hear your history there. So I'm going to jump right into my scary Indian wedding because, of course, you were talking about tradition. So obviously, how we feel about spoilers. There's not a spoiler if I just mention the Munglik, right?
Oh, no, not at all. Please go ahead. Yeah.
So there is a wonderful tie-in to Indian culture in your film, just as The Pay somewhat had. But I just want to say to you, if someone watches The Pay, the award-winning short, or horror short The Pay that you had on the festival circuit in 2021, won awards, excellent film. You know, film, I'm going to use the analogy of muscles. You know, a filmmaker's muscles, there's the script, there's the production design, there's the acting, there's the sound, there's VFX, and I feel completely confident saying that every single one of your muscles was stronger 2 years later, that as much as I adore The Pay, my scary Indian wedding, I just, you were just flexing your filmmaker muscles and in every way, every aspect of it is an improvement.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah, I mean, that's what you want to hear every time. If not the same, just a little bit better at least. It's horrible to regress. So I'm glad that this one, at least for the most part, most people say it's not a regression. So that's a win for us.
And I assume most people would. I mean, obviously, you learned a lot, right? Mm-hmm. Every film you make, you learn. And you're applying what you learned to the next one. So, you know, I mean, one of the strengths of The Pay is the visual effects and how you worked in modern technology and the way, you know, small screens and things affect our lives. But in my scary Indian wedding, you take it up a notch.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, when we made The Pay, we did it during like the height of COVID. And so we wanted to keep everything a little bit more like restricted. We had one character, one monster. So everything was a little bit more distanced. And literally you could tell in the design of the movie, it was very, very locked off, or very minimal camera movement. Not particularly my kind of style totally, but we were trying something new with the whole motion graphics part of it, with the social media aspect. So that is something that I was like, now I wanted to change completely with the with my scary Indian wedding and be like, now we're going to go full on balls in your face, Evil Dead, drag me to hell, but still manage to keep the motion graphics aspect of it. Because something that I'm really interested in is tech horror. And I want to bring that style and try to keep improving it, because I feel like so much of our lives that we live right now is so intertwined with technology. And I'm like, horror is something that always speaks to the time that it's in, whether you're talking about Night of the Living Dead or like you're talking about Texas Chainsaw Massacre or anything. They always kind of feed into the time somehow. And the way I want to feed into this time is through the use of how technology and the supernatural work together and goes, and you know, it's like just cutting loose on that whole aspect of things.
And that at the screenplay level, at the writing level, you are, you know, and I didn't even say, I just keep calling you filmmaker, but I mean, in this case, I mean, you are writer, producer, and director. And at the storytelling level, it's on the page where you are perfectly mixing technology and supernatural and solid appreciation for horror, the genre itself. So, I mean, was a lot of it on the page?
Yeah, because I spent a lot of time reworking the idea again and again, because I wanted to see, okay, what is the perfect, because I knew I wanted to make a movie about a wedding going wrong. That was the idea. And, you know, I wanted to lean into my whole, my heritage and all that stuff and say, okay, let's do an Indian demon. And then how to marry that, literally, sorry for the horrible fucking pun, and put that into the style that we had started with the pay. So I was like, okay, first we started with social media. Now maybe we move over to the matchmaking side of things. And so I was wondering how to do that. And then when I remembered this whole incident when I was a kid, when we went to like a cousin's friend's wedding, and I saw her, like, it was like we got there a little bit earlier, and I saw that they were doing some kind of weird ceremony where she was sitting next to a tree and there was something going on. And I was like, what are they doing over there? They're saying, oh, she's a Monglik, and that's why they're trying to get rid of, she's got bad juju. So they're trying to make her marry that tree, pass the bad juju off onto the tree. They'll have a goddamn divorce, and then they'll switch over and she'll marry her actual groom. I was like, that is fucking weird. And they were doing it early before the guests showed up and shit. So it seemed very illicit. That whole, it was like, it was almost like a sort of like an exorcism. It looked like that. I mean, it was still a wedding of some kind, but it came off to me of more exorcism vibes. And I was like, it stuck with me. So when I was looking for the idea of an Indian demon and a wedding gone wrong, immediately my head went to this image of this girl marrying this tree. And I was like, that Monglik aspect really came out back to my head. And then I was thinking, I wanted to take the Monglik and personify it, though, because, you know, just having it as a curse without actually seeing it would not be in the kind of vibe of cinema that I like. I really like stuff like Insidious, The Conjuring, The Ring, all of that stuff. So I wanted to personify that curse. So I said, I'm going to create my demon again. And like I did it with the Pay, and we created another demon on that. So I said, I'm going to create a demon called a Monglik and have it come after you and still talk about this aspect, the social stigma that exists in India where like certain women are considered bad luck because they're born at a certain day at a certain time. And that honestly has affected like their relationships, their chances of getting married. And then they have to do all this kind of ridiculous stuff as well to rid themselves of the curse, so to speak. So I thought that would be a fun but interesting way of tying those two things together, do an Indian demon horror movie while still dealing with something that actually exists as a social stigma in India.
For sure. And that extrapolates wonderfully to any culture, right? Because especially the way you tell it, you don't require people to have any of that information. It makes it clear right away. And just super compelling, I have to admit. And so the idea came from seeing that. And by the way, I think you're absolutely right. Like that was essentially an exorcism. They were exorcising a demon from her by having her wed the tree and then divorce the tree.
Yeah.
And I'm making fun of it, by the way, because every culture, I mean...
You can make fun of it, because I think it's fucking ridiculous, but...
I mean, I think it's fucking ridiculous to say that you put two of every animal on a boat.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. I mean, we come from, I honestly think like it's ridiculous in one sense because of how much stigma there is to it and how much I've seen it play and kind of sometimes ruin people in ways that it shouldn't have. But I also respect the idea of like, okay, that's the tradition. That's the way people thought at the time or certain people think, and that's fine. I get it. But also that doesn't mean we cannot bring it up and question it. Cause it's like you were saying, it kind of also ties into the idea of society in general. Like they say, like, you know, women have a certain, the so-called biological clock that they have to fight against. And I mean, it's not to say that's right and that's the way to think about it, but there is a social stigma when it comes to that, you know, like when it comes to like I have to get married and I have to do this because otherwise society is not going to accept me. So I thought using those ideas and you actually use a ticking time bomb in the movie, so to speak, with this app, this matchmaker app, was something interesting. There was this idea of mixing these two things. It's somewhat chaotic, but it's almost like it's chaotic in a way that when you see it on screen, it makes more sense than when you see it on a script. So when you were asking in terms of how does it work on a script, sorry for the very long-winded goddamn answer to that, but I wanted to get back to that, which is on the script, we have to be very particular because it's all like timing. It's very storyboarded. Me and my cinematographer, Tommy, who you've met as well a couple of years ago, he did the Q&A with us in the pay. We both sit and figure out like how does this visually going to translate the whole way. So we plan that out, do the script, then do storyboards, and then rewrite the script again based on the storyboards. Because you have to time when these motion graphics show up, you have to know exactly when it's going to show up, what part of the screen it's going to take. So you have to be able to frame the shot accordingly. And on the previous one in the pay, it was a little bit easier because more locked off shots, there was a more sterile style. Whereas in this one, it's like I was saying, we wanted Drag Me to Hell, we wanted Evil Dead, we wanted The Conjuring. So that is very dynamic and moves fast. There's a lot of steady cam moves. So we have to like know what part of the shot certain things are coming and time that out and rehearse it. And honestly, it's a mix of it's on the script, it's on the storyboards, it goes back in the script, and then we rehearse. I feel like all of those is part of the prep.
And you have a team who understands what you're going for. And yeah. and you have now, I mean, I actually haven't seen your films from before the pay, but clearly you're understanding how to utilize these visuals for storytelling, because I think that's one of the reasons why the film works so well, is none of the bells and whistles, as I'll call them, distract. They enhance the story. Like it's just about that drive to the finish line. I mean, it's also a bit of an adventure film, right? It's a horror adventure because your lead character, your cursed bridesmaid, I mean, she's kind of Keanu on the bus.
Yeah. that's 100% one way to put it. It's because I feel like I needed the ticking time bomb element for it to work for such a wacky concept, because it's such an out there idea of like this girl who has to find her, track down and marry her soulmate that an app tells her that is the right person to marry in order to beat this demon, in order to escape from this demon. You know, it's a really insane out there concept, but I'm a big fan of movies like The Ring, so I'm all for that in the sense of like it's a nice way of setting up a really wacky idea and also creating a sense of urgency as well. So like you said, it is an adventure film in its own way, mixed with the whole horror element. And I feel like the idea that when these characters have this ticking time bomb, they're not thinking straight. So they're forced to make these decisions that they probably normally won't do. And there are some certain decisions that she had to make in this movie that the idea of time and the lack of it forces you to make certain decisions that you would not normally see yourself doing.
Well, that's one of the great storytelling and filmmaking elements about it, is that we're being good. We're not giving spoilers. So, I mean, human beings will do things under extreme conditions. And one of the great things about this film is you manage to create the extreme condition that she is under quite early in the film, and she approaches it thankfully like a modern character and not, you know, I mean, we love the classic horror, but horror always relied upon people acting improperly, right? Like, there's a ghost in the house. I'm going to stick it out.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
I mean, like stupid decisions used to sort of be the crux of horror, at least in the 80s when they were really lazy.
Exactly. I mean, and for me, it's always, yeah, it pisses you off. Like when you see, like, it took 28 days for these people to leave the Amityville Horror House, you know, like, I mean, it's stuff like that. But I mean, I love it still, but I'm always like trying to like figure out a reason of why they stick around still. So like, I'm just saying, like, I'm a big fan of Insidious, and that's a great example of a movie where they can't escape the ghost because it's not, you know, they say it in the trailer, it's not the house that's haunted, it's your son. And so that's perfect. And they still get to make a haunted house movie, but it's the son that's bringing the demons out. So
rare, brilliant haunted house movie where they move.
Yeah, exactly. They move. And when I saw Insidious is when I was like, this is fantastic. And this is the kind of cinema that I want to make. It was truly inspirational because it came out at a time when horror, I think, was really weird. And it wasn't a place that was very popular, but I did not like where it was going because of the whole torture porn aspect of it. Like,
right, the post-Saw era.
Yeah, like, I mean, I like Saw because that's not what... Saw itself, the first Saw was great, but that's more because it was like a mystery thriller, and that was more Seven, but the stuff that people took from it was wrong. And anytime I saw anyone strapped to a fucking chair, I was like, oh, no, not one of these fucking movies. You know, like, it was, I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't good movies that do that. There are, but I personally just saw too many of them that I was like, what else? And then I walked into Insidious. I actually went to the cinema because I was like, let's give it a fucking chance. Like, cause I saw Dead Silence, which James Wan did. And I was like, I liked Dead Silence, even though I have my problems with it, but I thought it was still very scary. But this one, Insidious, was a masterpiece. So when I saw it, I kind of knew what I wanted to do from that point.
Excellent, excellent. And I think I was trying to say that your lead character, in spite of the supernatural aspect, she doubts the validity as much as anyone in the beginning, until the Munglik proves to her that this is actually happening.
Yeah.
She's not, it's not like, right? I mean, a lazier filmmaker would have just written, oh, she starts reacting right away. But no, she's doubtful. She doesn't take it seriously.
Yeah, and there's aspects of, I mean, I wanted to also keep making everyone question what they see. Like, so that's why we hold off on a lot of info for a very long time, and we keep the ambiguity very high just because it's such a wacky concept that I wanted it to feel just as ridiculous to the characters as it does to the audience. But ridiculous, but playing it straight though. Like, are you fucking kidding me? This is what you want me to do. Like, what are you, fucking nuts? And then when you actually like, oh no, they're not kidding. Like, this is what we want me to do. And like, even a lot of people, even when we were making the movie, we were like, oh, like, you know, a lot of crew members kept coming up to me like, oh, this actually could just be in her head in one way and all that. And I'm like, yeah, that's the idea, to see if we can kind of keep that balance the whole time because of how crazy the idea is.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess we'll avoid the ending, but
sure.
Unless you're... Yeah, we can avoid it because you're still on the festival circuit and everything.
Sure. I mean, yeah. I mean, we can enter a spoiler-filled section of this at some point.
Up to you. But I was going to say that you certainly answer though all those. Is it real or is it Memorex?
Yeah, that's it. For me, those movies are. I love the unreliable narrator trope. you know, like I'm a big fan of movies like The Usual Suspects, Sixth Sense, The Prestige. You know, like the idea that you question what came before. And the best, Psycho, for instance, like that's my favorite horror movie of all time. And the best horror movies or the best twist endings are the ones that make everything that you saw before better, not invalidating it. To me, there's that's why The Sixth Sense is the top twist of all time. And that's why Psycho is like right after it, you know? And then The Prestige, I feel, is very similar. Whereas, like, I love The Usual Suspects, for one. Like, I absolutely love it. But the one thing, the one trick that doesn't do that The Sixth Sense and all these other two did is that it sort of invalidates the whole thing before it. So you... In a way, I'm not saying it. I still think it's one of the best twist endings.
I haven't seen it for so long, but I was gonna add to what you're saying, which is what you're saying is one of the a late twist reforming, revealing an unreliable narrator and reframing everything that came before. The amazing thing about films like that is it makes them better on repeat viewing, right? Because if it's done well, and one thing about cinema is you haven't seen a film till you've seen it twice, right? At least.
I think so. I think the best ones make you see it twice. Even if you hate a movie, I think if it makes you want to come back and watch it twice, like, for instance, I feel that's what I was trying to do with this. How much we achieved that or not, I don't know. But I feel like I wanted people to question certain things, but not like question it like that, oh, they fucked up. And that's why it's ambiguous. I wanted it to be more like the question it like, oh, it could have just been this as well. Like maybe she's did this because she's fucking nuts and she's jealous and that's why she pulled off all this stuff to kind of lead to this part. But there is one point where I do make it kind of clear of what's going on, but I keep it, the whole idea was to keep it ambiguous for as long as possible. And I feel like endings, you know, like they're so important, because one, a bad ending to a great movie can really just ruin that whole movie, no matter how good that movie is. So I honestly think you can get away with making a very, very average movie for like a good 80% of it. And then if your ending is just super solid, I think you can save the movie technically. I'm not saying people should go do that, but.
And I agree with you in the cinema, but now we're all jerks. We all watch stuff at home on TVs, on streaming services, and it's really easy to stop. Like even a VHS or a DVD, I'm dating myself by not saying a Blu-ray, but right? Watching on streaming, it's a lot easier to quit early, right? And not stick it out to that end. I mean, a film that comes to mind is Saltburn.
And yeah.
With a really intense ending.
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
But I heard there is something that happens. So maybe... So I can't speak to Saltburn.
Right.
But like, say for instance, I don't know if you saw this. There's a movie called Skinamarink that it was like a horror movie on Shudder. So, I mean, there's these... Like you said, the idea that we can quit and then we miss out on something truly special. Because the guy, the filmmaker, the girl filmmaker took their own time building the world or whatever, because you also have to kind of let the story unfold. Like, I mean, the opening of Chinatown fucking takes forever before they get into how wacky it is.
The opening of The Exorcism.
Yeah. Yeah.
But exactly. There's something about those films. There's a quality, right? In the beginning, there's still a quality to them that sort of traps the audience. I mean, I'm actually imagining, I haven't asked you the million-dollar question yet of, is there a, because I know there's a feature version of The Pay in your mind. I don't know if there's a feature version of My Scary Indian Wedding in your mind.
Yes, there is, 100%. Like, this is made as a proof of concept. I'm honestly a little bit more excited to do this before The Pay, because I feel there's a lot more, it's a wilder story. The feature version is a way wilder story than I could come up with, like, that for The Pay. And I feel like there's a lot of characters. The best way to put it is, I mean, this is, I'm not trying to sound pompous here, but this is the only comparison I could think of. The opening scene of The Godfather is that it all takes place at this wedding. So imagine, this is, the whole movie is going to be that scene, but instead of a gangster movie, it's going to be a horror movie. So that's the idea for the feature. Like, in a nutshell, I'm not saying it's going to be The Godfather, so don't piss on me too early, but I'm saying that the number of characters coming in and out, we're going to see different facets of Indian families, wedding politics, racial politics, all that stuff, but all within the fun framework of a Friday night popcorn horror movie.
And I mean, I always tell you, I'm excited about these prospects, and I actually do understand why you'd be excited about the longer, the feature version of this compared to The Pay. As great as The Pay is, it's more of a straight up monster movie in its own way. But My Scary Indian Wedding has so many layers. Just so many layers. In fact, you just mentioned the racial politics. And I mean, one of the things I love about it is it's really not an issue. Right? Like, I love it. It's a very modern perspective on a mixed culture wedding.
Yeah. And
like I enjoy that. Like, how often have we seen that? We never get to see a white woman marrying an Indian man and just embracing the culture and not, you know, not going, oh, this is weird, you know?
yeah, exactly. No, and the thing is, it's a weird thing that is still very prevalent, in the sense that I feel like there's almost a lot of reverse racism that exists in some of these places. And sometimes it's like the mixed wedding, mixed race wedding in India can bring up those old wounds of the reverse racism too. It's all like bubbling under the surface, but it's not something that you want to put front and center, but you want to put it in there and have it just kind of linger and kind of haunt the whole proceedings without being talked about. And in this, even in the short, it's there. It's definitely there, but we didn't want to like be discussing that front and center. I mean, there's so much shit going on in this anyway that we're like,
that's, I mean, it's a dense short, and as always, I believe your instincts are excellent as far as running time, right? It's a tight 11 and a half minute film, basically, right? And I can tell you, a lot of people have told that story at 17 minutes.
I mean, that's an unfortunate problem that I have usually. Thank God, like, I kind of curbed it a little bit for this. But I tend to overstuff the hell out of these short proof of concepts. And this one, too, I do still believe that I did overstuff it a little bit. Like, personally, I think it could be a little bit simpler. I could have removed certain aspects of it. But I feel like from the reactions we've been getting, a lot of people have been appreciating that side of it, the overstuffed, slightly overstuffed nature of it that keeps it pacey.
Exactly. But it's the pace. We call it an adventure. It's a roller coaster ride. It's all of that. It's got the pace. And I'm going to mention another thing to praise, which, And there's a bit of an inside joke on this comment with myself and other members of the selection jury, which is, you can be somewhat accurate if you judge all films by their titles. You know what I mean?
That's pretty good.
Because if as particularly if it's a writer director situation, but even not, when the title just sings, it's rarely a bad film. And when the title is, oh God, I should not use an example, but with, I've seen many great films with the title Rideshare, but if you name your film Rideshare in this world, now that we've seen, I mean, if you run a film festival, you've now seen about 40 or 50 films where it's a serial killer driving for Uber. And it's just like, don't call it Rideshare. Call it something fucking else already. But anyway.
I know, 100%.
But I was going to try to say that I think, as crazy as I am, and I'm well confirmed to be an insane person, My Scary Indian Wedding is a title that should get you funding for a feature alone, because it just has a hook to it.
Thank you for saying that. I really appreciate you liking the title. It was something that I'm a big fan of, either like those one word titles, like say Psycho, Inception, those that style, or like these insanely long titles, like It's a Mad World, you know, like, or you know, like How the West Was Won or whatever. I'm a big fan of titles that either are like very subtle or like they tell you everything, like Attack of the Killer Tomatoes or The Man with the X-ray Eyes. I just like, I wanted to do like an exploitation style title for this. That's why I was like, let's just call it My Scary Indian Wedding. Like, this is where it's this kind of thing where the title, the log line, and the tagline are all the same fucking thing.
They are. And in this world we live in, by the way, I mean, if it gets, I mean, I'm going to put it out into the universe, this thing should be theatrical. And if you were looking, oh my God, we don't have newspapers. I don't know how, but if you see that there's a film called My Scary Indian Wedding playing at your local Cineplex, your decision has been made for you. If you enjoy horror and you enjoy humor and you enjoy intelligence, like, it's all in there. Like it just, so I just really, and of course, it's a wonderful callback to, you know, Big Fat Greek Wedding. Yeah, but thankfully you use one adjective instead of two. So but I mean, it's just, and Lord knows, especially it's streaming, right? Like you mentioned Shudder and this and that. Like if, you know, most of the stuff on Shudder, right, you haven't heard of unless you saw it on the festival circuit. But if you're flicking through titles with your, on your smart TV on Shudder or Netflix.
Yeah.
Or HBO Max or Max, but, and you saw My Scary Indian Wedding, you're like, oh, I know, I'm going to watch that because I have no idea what Rideshare is about. Well, but it sounds pretty plain, but My Scary Indian Wedding is going to be smart and funny and scary.
But yeah, I mean, that's the hope, because it's almost like I was saying, it was like going back to the idea of the days of exploitation, because back in the day, I mean, you could call a movie The Godfather, but you have no fucking idea what that movie's about. Right? Like, I mean, when I saw that title when I was a kid, I was like, The Godfather, is this just some goddamn movie about a grandfather or like some weepy fucking shit? And then when I saw that movie, I was like, oh, holy shit, this is The Godfather? Like, it's a fucking gangster movie? Whereas when you go in and you see a Roger Corman movie, like Bucket of Blood, you know what that is. You know what that is. And we're back in the day, back in the days of where, like you were saying, on streaming or whatever, you have to fight for real estate. You're competing against like the Marvel stuff. You're competing against ride shares of the world. You're competing against all this shit, the British Bake Off, you know, like all this crap. And I mean, crap meaning good stuff, but you want somehow with the, especially if you're in indie cinema, you want to somehow be able to push your title or your marketing front and center. And I feel like if the title is not obvious as to what it is, then at least your poster and marketing need to be and work well with the title. So it's almost like I personally try not to make a movie that I do not know how to market and title well, at least. Or at least the title should get me excited. Even if it's a one-word thing and it's subtle and you have no idea, it should somehow get you excited as an audience member. Like, suggestive of the genre, suggestive of the kind of tone, and suggestive of like literally an imaginary poster that you might have in your head and an imaginary marquee that you may or may not ever get in a theater.
And I mean, you're thinking as a producer besides, I mean, that's honestly, it's pretty impressive, right? Because you're thinking as the creator, as the writer and director, where you're focused on the art of it. And then you're the producer and you're thinking, you know, you're putting all the pieces together and all the people together. And then you're almost thinking about the next person along the line, the marketer, because you're thinking, how will this sit in the marketplace of ideas, right? Even film festivals are a marketplace.
Yes.
And streaming services are marketplaces. And if you're if you do something brilliant that has no call to action at a superficial level, right? If there's no basic appeal of that poster and title, then you are asking people, then you're only going to get the people who are just devoted to cinema. They're like, I'm just going to, you know, you're not actually going to get an audience. Like, you have to, you're making art for an audience. By the way, I would actually compliment you and say, when you're making the film, you're making it for an audience of one. You're making a film that you want to see. But then you're also thinking about how to market it. So I imagine if your working title had been the Munglik, you would have said to yourself, well, people are going to look at that and not know what it means. I got to change it.
Yep, exactly. I mean, that's the kind of thing that, like, I was trying to avoid because, you know, like, I'm just saying, we made The Pay. For some reason, I don't know why, that title seemed to catch enough attention from people. In general, I felt like it did, but it was like something like, you know, but it's like, what the fuck is it? What is The Pay? Right?
I think the hook there is also it's a spelling of a word that we never see, so it was unique.
Yes, exactly. It's like the Babadook or whatever. Like, but it sounds ominous enough. Like the title I was telling you about, Skin of a Rink. It sounds like, okay, there's something to it. That's what I mean by like, but trying to like the Babadook is a great example. Like, you just know there's something weird about this shit. Like, what is the Babadook? But if you just call the movie The Ghost, I mean, in one sense, you probably will get a certain audience for sure. But then on the other sense, it could also be like, where's the creativity here as well? So, like, I feel the title, like, literally, I knew that this is the title of the movie that we're making. I don't know what the fuck the movie we're making is, but I know, like, this is the title of the movie. And this is, like, what helped drive telling the story, too. Like, I was like, you have to deliver on the my, you have to deliver on the scary and the Indian wedding part. Like, you have to tick all these boxes. So I was like, my, you have to tick the idea that you're telling it from a very particular perspective. The scary, you better fucking deliver on the scares. That's the thing. When I was telling people about, whenever I tell people about this movie, they think it's a fucking horror comedy. And I almost like the idea that they're kind of coming in thinking, oh, it's going to be like Cabin in the Woods or whatever. And then they're like, it's actually a fucking full-on horror movie. You know, like, I like you kind of lure them in for this Friday night fun movie, but yet you kind of are, it's just a little bit scarier than it should be.
I agree. Although I will make one point without spoilers, which is, I think your final shot is subtly humorous.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I think your ending, there is...
100%.
It's... And when you can make something horrifying or you know, just subtly funny, I just think that is, you know, I'm out of adjectives. It's like high praise. Like, everybody wants that. That's what you want. You want a story that, like, at the end, you're like, I should feel bad for them, but I'm kind of laughing at the look on their faces.
Yeah, no, 100%. Like, that's why I was like, it needs to deliver on that title. It's like My Scary Indian Wedding, but like that end is that title. That 100%, for me at least, it is that title. Like, you delivered on your promise, so to speak. And it's just that I've seen a particular type of ending where, you know, the monster shows up. I'm not going to reveal the ending of this, but the usual ending of the short film, which I'm also done many times, which is the monster comes and cut to black. In this one, I was like, can we just not fucking do that again? Like, what is something else we could do? And then I thought of without giving it too much away, I thought of another movie, that a very specific movie that had a very similar title. I mean, a very similar type of ending from like old Hollywood. And I was like, I think I know how to do this.
So I'll share. I'm gonna get a little more personal with you.
Sure.
I don't know if you watched the Q&A that I did with Patrick and was the cinematographer?
No, that was the composer, Thomas.
The composer, right. So your lead actor, Patrick Rutnam, and your composer were able to be at the theater and see it on the 70-foot screen DCP. Beautiful. Oh, it looked beautiful. But okay. I did tease you. Did you hear when I teased you?
I
joked that this film also has an element of, like, if you want to marry Ramon, if you want to get this man to the altar, it might have to be a life or death situation.
Probably. That's one way to put it.
Although the truth is, the way you explained the way the idea came to you, it is not at all actually your I'm getting married. I'll be kicking and screaming to the last second. It actually is not. That is, you have proven to me that is not the unconscious message of the film. And I was just putting that on you unfairly.
It's the funny thing is when there's a point of the movie where the guy in the movie, even after certain things have been revealed to him, even at that point when the girl is asking him the question, he's still looking for another way. And the thing, because the reason I can't help myself, because I'm a big Brian De Palma fan, and Ryan De Palma, and to a certain extent Hitchcock too, they have this uncanny ability to throw humor in at the worst time. Like in Carrie, when Carrie is destroying the entire prom, like people are getting fucking slaughtered, and there's that bucket that falls on John Travolta's head as he's making his escape. One of the great comedic timing moments of all time. And so whenever I'm writing this stuff, I'm always like, can we sneak that shit in there somehow? Like, just at the worst possible time. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes I kick myself in the theater for, like, even though people are laughing and it works, I'm just like, fuck, did I really have to make it funny at that moment? You know, like, and on some screenings, you're like, oh, I'm so glad I made it funny at this moment. It just depends on the day, because honestly, I love movies like The Exorcist, where it just doesn't relent. It's an unrelenting horror movie. But my natural style tends to be where I can't help throw some funny shit in there if I can figure it out.
Absolutely. I mean, look, in the end, you're being true to yourself when you do that, because I mean, surely you do have a serious side and it certainly takes a lot of seriousness to go from page to screen. But you have a great sense of humor. So it'd probably be to your deficit if you didn't let it creep into your work. And I wanna say another thing, which is something I do notice is, you know, it's often an issue. All right, so my bias is two film festivals a year. The two added together get about 1,500 submissions a year. That's a lot of indie films to look at. I joke that I start 1,500 films a year. I don't finish 1,500 films a year, but I finish a lot of them. And sometimes the derivativeness wears you down as a viewer because you see the nods, you know, but really you're not derivative. You do occasional salutes to things you've loved in classic cinema or even recent cinema. But, you know, it's sort of like, I guess I'll mention Tarantino. Like, it's a Tarantino thing. It's like, he's just so well versed in the encyclopedia of cinema that he just, when he does a salute to something, it's natural and intrinsic to his story. And it's just, you know, here's a moment that, you know, if someone has seen the same movie as me, they'll know I'm nicking something, but the truth is it just fits perfectly. And I mean, there's nothing in the two films of yours that I've seen that make me go, oh, he pulled that from here, he pulled that from there. But you have such an encyclopedic knowledge of horror specifically, but, you know, you're mentioning, you know, hacks like Hitchcock and Coppola as well. So, I mean, you know, I was fun to call them hacks, but, but when you, but yeah, you make it your own when you do a nod or you pull something from something you love.
Yeah. I got into make this stuff in general with the idea of being a very derivative prick about it because the kind of filmmakers that I liked were always taking from somebody else. And I just enjoyed that very much. Like I was talking about Brian De Palma, like Dress to Kill is Psycho. And I was like, I'm going to watch this Dress to Kill because people say he's just basically ripping off Psycho. That's the reason I wanted to watch it. And if you go to Psycho, the reason Hitchcock made that movie was because he wanted to beat Diabolique. And, you know, that French movie that Henri-Georges Clouzot made. And because in Diabolique, there's a bathroom scene and it's very horrific. And Hitchcock's like, how dare this fucking Frenchman think that he can beat me? And they're calling him the master of suspense. Fuck him. I'll do a bathroom scene and I'm going to beat his fucking bathroom scene. And if that's not called derivative, it's called you're feeding off of that. Yet it is somewhat derivative, but it's also in the best way. And I'm just like, now these two assholes trying to beat each other gave us two great movies by trying to beat out each other's style. And I feel that for me, that's more exciting than me trying to come up with something totally original that is like there that doesn't pull from anything. Like I'm almost like I get more excited saying like there's a Manhunter reference in My Scary Indian Wedding. No one will know where the fuck it is, but I know 100% where it's stuff like that. There's like there's a Nicholas Rogue reference in there, but I know it's like a direct. I'm taking it and throwing it in there, but for me, it's the fun of the remix. It's like the remixing. It's like Dr. Dre and all these guys. I mean, the whole idea of hip hop, you know, like how they take it. I love the remix songs more than the originals sometimes because they're taking something and fucking with it and making it their own thing. It's like that. What is that? There's a Beatles album cover where they just put shit from all. I forgot what the fuck.
I think it's Sgt. Pepper probably.
Yeah, Sergeant Pepper.
Yeah, the collage, yeah.
Yeah, the collage. When I see that, I'm like, that's what I want to do. You know, like, that's the kind of stuff that I want to do. I think it's the Beastie Boys. The Beastie Boys, they made a record that's like, every fucking song is like
Paul's Boutique. Yeah. That record literally forced the music industry to figure out sampling royalties because they sampled the entire fucking thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I love that shit. Like, to me, that kind of thing is where my proclivities go towards. Like, I would love to say I would want to be like an Antonioni or a Terrence Malick type, but I just know that I don't have the talent to do stuff like that. And second of all, that's not the stuff that would make me excited to make movies. Watching that stuff, I'm excited, but to make movies like that. I'd rather be like, did you see the Psycho 2 reference? Like, you know, like it's like an inside joke thing. And that's the kind of stuff like I'm giggling about, but all in a framework of something that looks original, but it's like, it's not totally original. It just looks like that.
Well, like, I mean, originality is beautiful, but you know, we are standing on the shoulders of giants, and now you've got my head spinning, because I was quite the Nicholas Rogue fan back in the day, and I have no idea where your Nicholas Rogue reference is. And I have no idea. I was one of those assholes who walked around saying when Silence of the Lambs came out, I'm like, y'all should have seen Manhunter instead. Forget this over the top Hannibal. Look at the Hannibal, right? It was Brian Cox, wasn't it?
Brian Cox
was the first. I'm like, look, check out that. That was Michael Mann, right?
Yep.
Michael Mann. I mean, check out Manhunter. So yep. Now I'm like, I miss these references. See, so if you do it well, even if people are a fan, all you're doing is just using the language of cinema.
Yeah. I mean, there's a graduate reference in there too. And that's what I'm saying. We're like pulling from shit that's not specifically just horror. And like even the Nicholas Rogue, it's not from Don't Look Now. It's from something else. It's another Rogue. But the thing is, that's where it's fun for me. I'm the only asshole who fucking know this shit too, because in the sense like it's so buried in there that, and who the hell else would care enough to want to look into it? But for me, it's the fun part of like putting the collage together, so to speak. And it's not like, oh, I have to throw in this reference. It's more like as I'm writing it, it's like you just remember something and you're like, oh, this is a perfect time for this guy and this guy.
So you're not forcing it in. It's just you're seeing a moment and you're like, yeah, and you're just directing it, you know?
Yeah, we got a very obvious Fincher reference in there, as you know. And it's you know, that's the more hit the nail on the head kind of thing. But pardon the pun. But I feel like it's the kind of thing that's to me is the more exciting part of creativity, like trying to use all these different things in. And again, it's not just movies. It can come from music. It can come from some random painting. It can come from a random photo as well. There's a lot of, like, the person we looked at a lot for this movie was Gregory Crudson, in terms of the photographer, in terms of, like, we wanted the colors to be really saturated, but we wanted it to be very contrasty at the same time. So, like, that kind of thing, like, me and my cinematographer, Tommy, we basically co-write these things. Like the script for these things are absolute garbage. When you look at it, it's just like, this is literally, we don't treat it like a holy document. We just treat it like, okay, it's literally like a like scratched up notes on a blueprint to help us make the movie. The storyboards are more important to me than the script, I think.
Because that's when it starts becoming visual for you?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. For me, I personally like to treat these in my head, at least more than the script. I personally treat it like comic books, you know, like mangas and comic, or like graphic novels. I feel like it's more fun to think of it like that than, because for me, when I read the script, there are great scripts. I mean, if you read like Marty and Network and all that kind of shit, it's like, oh, wow, look at this stuff. Like really jumps off the page. I was reading the Oppenheimer script. I was like, that's fucking amazing what he did with that. But me personally, I think of it that I'm more interested in the comic book, the storyboards, like that whole approach. To me, that's where the real important document is.
I mean, that's actually one of the things that blew my mind. When I got to college, it was when the graphic novel was actually having its heyday, and The Dark Knight Returns and
yes.
And a few other key Ronin and this and that. And I had been into film. And as soon as I saw my first graphic novel, I was like, well, this is storyboarding. I never really, because I hadn't been exposed to comics as a kid. So I didn't grow up on comics. So then I learned in college, I'm like, No wonder comic books make such great movies. They're already storyboarded.
Yeah, exactly. And it's great. And yet it's different in its own way. Yet you can still. It's not like I'm saying that it needs to be necessarily like there's the comic book From Hell, the Alan Moore one. I mean, totally different comic book, totally different movie. I mean, I love both of them for very different reasons. I think that movie is like one of the most inspirational movies. The Hughes brothers made it with Johnny Depp. And the comic book is a totally different beast altogether. The comic book's told from the perspective of Jack the Ripper and the Inspector. Two totally different perspectives, and the movie is just the Inspector. But that comic book just showed me, like, oh wow, it's a totally different language altogether. Like, this cannot be this movie. There's no way. There's certain comic books that are very easy to translate, like the Sin City stuff that Frank Miller did. But the ones that recently that I've seen, like, I'm totally inspired by, is Junji Ito, the Japanese manga artist. This guy is doing scares on the page. And I'm like, you cannot translate that into cinema, but it definitely inspires you to be like, okay, how would I translate this in a totally different way? And it's a skill that I'm still learning and want to keep learning, because I feel like that guy's a master in terms of scaring you on the page. You do the page flip and you're like, what the fuck is this? And it's like a double page. And he knows how to do it. And it's like, in cinema, we can do it with the cut, right? So, or the camera move. So that's something that I want to get better at and keep learning from. I think we're just starting to scratch the surface with this scary Indian wedding, with that side of it.
Right, and that you're balancing out the scares, the general scariness with the jump scare, is right. That's sort of the, well, I don't know. I'm a bit of a horror aficionado now. I think you remember my story that I wasn't really into horror, and then 4 years ago when my stepdaughter came home from a sleepover and said, "I only watch horror movies now," I started watching two a weekend with her all through COVID and everything.
Yeah.
So I've really learned the breadth and brilliance of horror. Seen all the what's new, because clearly, look, I was a kid of the 80s and you know, after a brilliant start, right? After Halloween and Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street, it was like, okay, there's a lot of potential for horror to have a renaissance, and then it just turned into a slasher. Like, it just, they took what they thought was the commercial success, the cause for commercial success, and just did it. And so, you know, it got boring.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, honestly, there's very few movies. I mean, there's The Changeling, but I don't know if that's a 70s or 80s movie, but I can't think of too many. There's some cool ones here and there, but like nothing like that. Especially the foreign ones were pretty good. There was like Angst and stuff. That was great. But 80s and 90s, yeah. Even the 90s, like, other than Scream, in terms of like horror movies, and The Sixth Sense and The Blair Witch at the end, all that shit in 1999, that was a great period. But then again in the 2000s, it was crappy. But then once this Insidious hit, I think it just picked up. I think Insidious is the start. Everyone says Paranormal Activity, but I really think it's Insidious. Insidious is the one that just showed people like movies can be scary again, like actually physically.
Yeah. Scary. And well made, well told, involving stories, involving, you know, Lord knows that I can promise you there were movie executives in the 80s and 90s who said, people don't care who the characters are. Just start killing them. It just has to be good deaths. Give me, you know, it might have had a decent hook as a story, Final Destination. But the truth is, it was just death porn. It was just, how are we going to kill people in a way they haven't seen someone killed before?
Exactly. And for me, the best version of Final Destination was already done years ago with The Omen. You know, like The Omen fucking, that's that story. Final Destination just does it without the kid and all that shit. But I think the kid and the devil and all that makes it more fun. The Omen is one of my favorites. And I feel like when you were talking about the scares, I personally am a fan of the jump scare. Like I feel, I don't know, maybe it's growing up in India or whatever. It's like literally the bang for your buck. There could be a movie that's pretty crappy, but if it had like two or three good scares, like actual proper scares, not when the fucking cat jumps out or not some shit with some friend at the window. I'm talking about the actual, like the, they got us with the monster or the ghost or whatever. I feel that to me is way more skillful than doing a great character driven horror movie that never gets scary. You know, like I feel like there's a delicate balance. Like Hereditary, I think, did that well. I still have some problems with Hereditary, but it's still excellent where there's character, there's the scares, the it ticks the boxes where you're happy. And then there's certain horror movies, I don't want to mention it because I might fucking run into some of these people someday, but recently, where it's the part of this elevated horror shit, and I'm like looking at this and I'm like, what the fuck? You know, like me and my composer and a friend of ours, went to watch this particular movie that played at Sundance and played all the big festivals and everyone was praising and all that. And we saw it and we were like, what the fuck was that? Has nothing, like zero. What's the praise for? The drone, the sound of the drone that you had playing the whole fucking time? Or was it the tone? I'm like, anybody can do that shit after a while. You know, like when people are like, oh, it had a ominous tone. Yeah, but what else are you going to do with that tone? So I kind of can criticize some of the movies that have only jump scares and then can get irritating. But I also get irritated with the opposite side where it's all this high art shit and it doesn't deliver on the basic nature of being a horror movie.
It's true. Those need to, if they don't deliver on what a horror film needs, and like, so one I loved in a way and was Saint Maud.
Yes.
Because that ending worked for me.
Yeah, that punches you.
But if it's a slow creep for 90 minutes and then it's over without even just a non-horror ending, but if you just give me, wrap that story up in a way that works, whether it's horror or not. But sometimes, yeah, sometimes they've gotten a little lazy. Well, also, yeah, there's streaming services that realize, oh, we'll just put anything up. It feels that way.
Yeah, no, but it's also, I feel like there's the something about it bothers me is with the critics. I feel like there are certain movies that get very high Rotten Tomato scores. Like, and these thrillless thrillers and these scareless horror movies. And I don't know what happened. I feel like we're living in an age where there's a lot more toxic positivity going on in terms of the reviews of certain movies. And then certain movies that are actually fucking great get shat on. There was a movie called The Night House that was outstanding. With Rebecca Hall in it. I think it's probably one of the greatest horror movies of the last 20 years. Doesn't get enough praise. And that's a movie that does the scares, it does the character, does the art of it. And it deserved to be like up there in the pantheon of great horror movies. Whereas then I've seen some other ones that get all this praise and you're like, how? You know, it doesn't make any sense. But like I was saying, I just lean towards the James Wan side of things. I think he's an absolute master. Like, I think he's one of the greatest directors of all time because he's actually directing the audience. The timing of the shots, the timing of the edits, the movement of the camera. It's like a magic trick that he's pulling the whole time. And these sequences are not like quick, like scare sequences and oh boom and scare. It's sustaining. It goes on for like 7-8 minutes and you're like, who is this guy? When I first saw how he was pulling this off, I was like, this is like masterful stuff. And everyone wants to try that, but it's one of the most difficult things to do. So I think when people talk shit about jump scares, I think they're just talking shit about like bad jump scares.
Yeah, and you're making me, you've backed me in the corner where I have to say that some film reviewers, if they're not a fan of a genre, mm-hmm. and they still review that genre, their reviews become pretty irrelevant, right? Because if you don't appreciate what's good in horror, then you're going to maybe praise the horror film that you say, it's so brave that it's never scary and never interesting. I'm so, like, I once, in the early years of the festival, before I, when I believe in democracy instead of tyranny,
mm-hmm.
I would occasionally allow other people had more input into the final program.
Sure.
And so the first year, maybe I have to tell you off the microphone. But needless to say, once I had to start a Q&A by saying to a filmmaker, I really respect how brave it was for you to make a film with no likable characters. But there could be a good film with no reliable characters. This one wasn't. I mean, likable characters. But
yeah.
it feels like the praise for some horror films that is undeserved is because it's being reviewed by people who don't appreciate the genre. Just be like, you know, my best friend had a saying, I don't like horror. I don't like war movies.
Yeah.
Make a movie about a war. I don't care if it's as brilliant as Saving Private Ryan. I don't care if it's this, that, the other. I just don't enjoy it. It's not for me.
Correct.
So that person shouldn't review war films.
Exactly. I'm one of those people. I'm not the biggest war movie fan too. So like, say for instance, my opinion on Dunkirk would not be as valid as someone who loves the war movies, right? And it's I feel like sometimes, like when critics watch these movies, they're like, oh, that's a movie that didn't have the typical horror tropes, so that's why it must be great. And I'm like, no, it's just boring, like after a while. So that side of it is weird. Like, say for instance, there's a movie called The Lighthouse, which is a horror movie in spirit, in all the ways. But it doesn't have the so-called typical scares and stuff. But the way they do the movie does not make you believe at the end that, oh, this is a typical horror movie. And I like it for that. He was bold enough to say, like, it's okay, I made a movie that was called The Witch, and that was a full-on horror movie, but I'm going to do something totally different. And you might have come in here thinking it's a horror movie, but this one is, like, told totally differently. When you do it like that, and you kind of make it clear that it's not the most typical horror movie, I think then it's fine. You know, like, because I really liked The Lighthouse. A lot of people have problems with it, but I think it's a masterpiece of its own kind. But it's these thrillless and scareless horror movies that I feel sometimes get too much praise. But yeah, I mean, but I still feel like we're living in a golden age of horror, regardless of all of that.
I hear you. All right, well, back to Scary Indian Wedding. Might as well push you back on, because Lord knows we can shoot the shit about film and horror and just film in general for a while. But yes. So are you devoting like 17% of the back of your mind to how to get it made as a feature, or is the feature script already all worked out? Are you working on that level?
So I've got the feature script, but I'm still reworking it, because I will rework these scripts until we shoot. Like, that's just the way I always want to see how do we just make it better. So I've got the version that I feel like I'm happy with, but I know I will keep developing it. But at the same time, I also want, I'm prepping another film that I'm going to be doing soon, because I just, while getting ready for the feature, I also like to keep filming, just so that learn more tricks. You can never stop learning, honestly, with this, especially with the kind of stuff that I want to do. I feel like I need to learn more tricks that I can employ and throw that towards the feature. So yeah, I would say the feature is super important, but I'm also doing another project in the same time, just to help with the feature in terms of help with the style and the storytelling. That's something I want to experiment with this new movie that will inform the future of My Scary Indian Wedding.
Right. I mean, to go back to my really borderline worthless metaphor, analogy, is you're going to the gym. You're going to the filmmaker's gym and working out those muscles, because the more you work them out, the more you can put them to use in the next one.
Exactly. It's a very expensive gym, but it depends on which part of town you're going to as well. You can work out your filmmaker workout with a camcorder, your iPhone too, you know, like test out, do like test shoots. That could be a little short films. Like David Sandberg does these amazing short films with him and his wife. I think those are the most inspirational things. Like, he's just him, his wife, and their house, and they're fucking scary as hell. And this is the guy who's doing Shazam. And the fact that he can come in on the weekend and shoot a little movie with his wife and do all the sound effects and all that stuff is truly inspirational. That's the kind of stuff I mean as well. There's the bigger movies that you want to do as the shorts, but there's also these like tiny films that I think will help as you get ready to do a feature. Because I'm just saying, if you want to be a baseball player and a hitter, and if you're not hitting all the time, it's going to be very tough when you actually go to the big leagues. For me, one of the scariest things is going and shooting a feature, but not having shot anything for about 6 to 8 months before that, because then you're trying to like do the warm up as you're doing probably a very, very, very important project. And that's not an ideal situation to be showing up in. You'd rather shoot a movie in a warehouse with your friends over the weekend, like a couple of weeks or months right before shooting your feature, because that way you're getting used to the idea of telling them, giving instructions, clear instructions, because that's the other thing, the whole communication part of filmmaking that you want to do, it's really important leading into it. So yeah, to answer your question, yes, I'm 100% be prepping for My Scary Indian Wedding, the feature, but I'm doing it alongside these other projects as well.
Another project or two, you've got a few short ideas percolating, and if and when,
yeah,
they tell you when they're ready to be made.
Yes, there's one that I'm pretty excited by that I feel like we're going to film very soon, because I feel like the idea is so fucking ridiculous. It's so insane that even when I showed it to some people, they're like, yeah, it's ridiculous. But like you said, if you play it straight, there's a movie in this. And I feel I'm pretty excited by it just because of how out there the concept is. But it's also still in the wheelhouse of the kind of stuff that I've done, because I want to get better at the horror. And I feel like that's where I'm putting all my concentration at the moment. And I feel like this idea is a good basis as a jumping off point to allow me to learn more about the horror side of the scares and the tension and all of that, that I want to keep learning.
Excellent. Excellent. I mean, you know, if I had the power of an omnipotent being, I would make sure that you get to make films for the next 20, 30 years. Cause you're the kind of person that should be making them. I have to say, I'm not just blindly kissing your ass. I'm intentionally kissing your ass, because you know, what can I say? You've got all the right perspectives and all. I just really appreciate the way you approach the medium and the way you combine the art of cinema and appreciation for cinema with also an understanding of entertainment and enjoyment and marketing and, you know, literally feels like you're doing it right.
Thank you. I really, really appreciate you saying that. It's a nice feeling to try to mix it all together and see what comes out of it. I mean, like for me, my heroes are guys like Roger Corman, William Castle, Stanley Kubrick, because I like those, and Hitchcock, all that, because not just because they were great filmmakers and all that. It's just that because they just were looking at the whole side of it. Like, we need to see everything, pre-production to how audiences are going to see it in the theater. Like, and you want to innovate and try to be as creative as possible with that side, because it's fun, like, you know, trying to figure out a cool trailer like recently there was a trailer for this movie called Long Legs that looks fucking outstanding that this guy named Oz Perkins, the son of Anthony Perkins, is making. It's one of the most punk, badass fucking trailers I've seen. And I'm so glad that that exists. That is one of the most inspirational things that I've seen recently, the trailer for that movie, Long Legs. And you want, for me, that's the kind of thing that I want to keep doing. And let's hope that even with the shorts, you know, like do something that's a little wild and out there and have guys like you help us promote it and put up festivals where at Sherman Oaks, I saw some of the great, great movies in when we went with the pay and even Patrick, my actor, and Thomas were the composer were talking about how they enjoyed the programming at this year's festival too. So you guys play a big part of that as well in helping us figure out how wild we can get with it, but also how to also keep our feet on the ground to make sure people watch the shit too.
I hear you. And I appreciate, of course, thank you for that. We decided after that first year that I made reference to no bad films. It's just so important to me that when you see your film on screen, when someone comes to the Sherman Oaks Film Festival or Film Invasion Los Angeles, they're going to go home and say, every movie I saw was great.
Yeah.
And one of the things I enjoy most is when people leave our festival and go, because I love to do a mishmash too. Although I think in 2021, I think the pay was in an all horror block, which is rare. But,
correct.
But I think this year my Scary Indian Wedding might have been in a nice potpourri, as I call it, block, an eclectic block. And there's nothing better than when someone walks out and goes, you know what? I just saw a comedy, a horror, and a sci-fi and a drama all in the same block, because we don't go more than four.
Yeah.
And I'm not a horror person, but the horror film was my favorite. I just love getting that kind of, it just shows that if people are forced to watch things they don't normally watch, they find out that maybe they should be a little more open-minded. But anyway, quality is job one.
No, and I think it's great. It's like, there's that show called Robot Chicken that I used to watch where they just switched the channels and like just something different would pop up. And I love that style of like programming as well. Of course, I love when you just do genre stuff as well. But I like the idea that you have no fucking clue what you're going to see next. Like you could have no idea. And it could piss people off at some points, but I think it's exciting to, if you like movies in general, it's exciting to be watching a black and white fucking silent film. And then the next one is My Scary Indian Wedding. You know, like you're like, that was a very exciting trip that I went on, saw this cool silent black and white movie. And then they went and did this fucking exploitative horror movie that came right after it. And it's a nice way. I mean, for me personally, because I'm just a cinema fan in general, I like that kind of combo.
Yeah. Excellent. All right. Well, I guess we should wrap it up. I think we've subjected this very lucky audience to nearly a 90-minute chat.
Yeah. I'm sorry for,
no, don't apologize. I'm glutton for it. and I guess last time, you had shared when you did this podcast two years ago that people should just follow you on Instagram at Ramon Menon, which yes. I can just make a clickable link.
Sure, yeah. I kind of try to
webpage or anything people should know about, or
well, I try to keep it there because I realized like when I had all the different accounts, I was just not really keeping up with it. One place, Instagram. Maybe one day a TikTok will show up. You never know. But for now, an Instagram is where I'm at.
For real. And Lord knows websites, like you put up a website and then you don't think about it for a year or two. And then someone visits your website and like there's nothing new for 2 years and everything you care about isn't on there yet. And it is an antiquated you know, it's almost like a time capsule, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. I mean, some people are really good at keeping up with that stuff. I'm not. So that's why I choose the Instagram, because I'm like, okay, it's a visual medium. I'm just going to throw something visual on there and give a little bit of information if I can. And let's hope it keeps it relevant.
Absolutely. All right. So, well, yeah. I will make that a clickable link in the show notes. And now everyone gets to enjoy my final spiel / ramble / whatever. I'm going to try to say this as quickly as possible because, oh, you know, it almost bores me to say all this, but I need to. Thank you, everyone, for watching. Ramon and I didn't even introduce this as we're on Zoom. And I don't think we ever spoke over each other, but there's a micro delay in Zoom that doesn't affect us while we're talking. And then I go back and if I go back and listen to it, I'm like, oh, there's a little overlap in our words because it turns out technology isn't perfect. So anyway, if Ramon or I spoke over each other, I swear to God, we didn't do it in person or we didn't do it in the moment. It's just, you know, blame the Zoom Corporation and the multi-billion dollars they have thanks to COVID. But anyway, thank you for listening to the Discover Indie Film Podcast. If you want to learn more about this podcast or the Amazon TV series that was born from it that is of the same name, just go to discoverindiefilm.com. On social media, it's always at DIFWINS. I did mention that TV series. If you go to Amazon Prime Video and type in Discover Indie Film in the search field, amusingly, you type in Discover, IND, and you see Discover India and Discover Indie Film. As soon as you do the E in Indie, you got it. But it is funny. There's a program called Discover India that comes up first.
Oh, I know. I'm aware of it.
Are you aware of it? And so that's the discussion. Oh, and if you want to be nice, like and subscribe to the podcast and give it 5 stars if you see it anywhere. Give that TV series 5 stars on Amazon Prime. And we talked about the Sherman Oaks Film Festival that has hosted 2 of Ramon's films over the last 3 years. Just learn about it by going to ShermanOaksFF.com, and it's at ShermanOaksFF on social media. Film Invasion Los Angeles is its sister festival. We hold that one every June. You can learn about it at FilmInvasionLA.com, and it's at FilmInvasionLA on social media. I'll not humble brag, I'll bragging brag that both festivals are in the top 100 best rated on Film Freeway, which is the only submission platform left in this world. So the filmmakers have spoken, and Sherman Oaks Film Festival and Film Invasion Los Angeles are 2 of the top 100 in the world out of 12,000. And nice. I'm the festival runner of both, so go figure. I go to sleep at night happy about that and miserable about everything else in my life. But anyway, just kidding. And the last thing I'll mention is go to watchtvhigh.com. TV High is a smart TV app that's on, what is it on? It's on Roku, Amazon, Fire TV, Apple TV, Android TV. It's on your iPhone and iPad. It's on Android Mobile. And TV High is a great streaming service filled entirely with indie films and some classic cinema and some stand-up comedy. And it's my, you know, I just can't help it. I see so many great things on the festival circuit, and I'm frustrated with the lack of distribution that people get. And TV High is another attempt to solve that riddle with the added bonus that it's just excellent content. And if you happen to be stoned, it's even better. But it's good even if you're sober. But it's called TV High because watchtvhigh.com. There, I've said my piece. And Ramon, thank you as always.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Appreciate it. Again, everyone, thank you for listening.